Adams, that whenever America shall manifest a real determination to fulfill her part of the treaty, Great Britain will not hesitate to prove her sincerity. For Adams, who had argued emphatically at Paris for full repayment of American debt and had never deviated from that view, American reluctance or inability to make good on its obligations was a disgrace and politically a great mistake. When word reached London that some states, including Massachusetts, had passed laws against compliance with the treaty, Adams was appalled. Any such suspension of British debts, however colored or disguised, was a direct breach of the treaty, he wrote in a fury to Cotton Tufts, who had become a member of the Massachusetts Senate. Our countrymen have too long trifled with public and private credit. He would make good on all outstanding debt to British creditors. And if the British posts in America were not then immediately evacuated, he would declare war. But he had written this when wroth and fretted. War was the last thing he wanted. Any war now would be calamitous for the United States and must be avoided at almost any cost, he wrote another day. What was implicit in all oratorical utterance from Whitehall, Adams knew, was that to the British there was as yet no proper American government, and so it would be pointless to undertake serious transactions until such existed. To Adams, it was particularly offensive that the British thus far had not thought it necessary even to appoint an ambassador to the United States. In an exchange of letters between London and Paris, meantime, he and Jefferson considered the question of whether to pay tribute to the Barbary pirates or wage war with them. Jefferson recommended war as more honorable and proposed that an American fleet be built. Adams agreed in principle and promised, "I will go all lengths with you in promoting a navy." Like Jefferson, he detested the prospect of paying bribes. But given that there was no American navy at present, and that it would be years most likely before Congress voted such a resolution, Adams thought it sensible to pay the money. "We ought not fight them at all unless we determine to fight them forever," he told Jefferson, who willingly deferred to Adams's judgment. Later in January 1787, they would sign a pact with Morocco, whereby the United States, like France and Britain, agreed to pay for protection. Eager for a break from the doldrums of summer in London, with Parliament in recess and everyone fled from the city, the Adamses decided to see some of the English countryside. With Nabby and Colonel Smith, they set off for a week-long excursion to Essex. Adams had expressed interest in visiting the village of Braintree, expecting they might find some connection with their own Braintree. But poking about in the village graveyard, he found no familiar names, and the village itself was sadly disappointing, poor and miserable. Still, the trip was a welcome departure, and for Abigail especially, and even more welcome was the wholly unexpected journey that followed immediately afterward. Adams was needed at The Hague to exchange ratification of the treaty with Prussia, the one European trade agreement that he and Jefferson, for all their efforts, had succeeded in accomplishing. The treaty, signed in July 1785, had been ratified only that May of 1786, so late that unless it were signed within a matter of weeks, it would expire. Since Prussia had no minister in London or Paris, but only at The Hague, Adams was needed there without delay, or the treaty would come to nothing. Jefferson excused himself from attending, saying it was on too short notice. "As this presents a good opportunity for seeing the country, Holland," Abigail wrote happily, "I shall accompany him." In fact, they were both extremely pleased to be going. Little could have delighted Adams more than the chance to show her the country that meant so much to him, where success had been his, where, as they both appreciated, he had helped change the course of history, and where he was still the accredited American minister, Congress having never bothered to replace him. They were gone 5 weeks, stopping first at The Hague for the signing ceremony on August 8th, then moving on at a pace sufficient to see just about everything, Rotterdam, Delft, Leiden, Haarlem, Amsterdam, Utrecht, with Abigail supplying colorful comment in her letters. "Not a hill to be seen," she wrote, incredulous. The people were well-fed, well-clothed, contented. The women notable for their beautiful complexions. "Rouge is confined to the stage here," she reported approvingly to Nabby. She saw no poverty such as in Paris and London. The cities were amazingly clean and orderly. "It is very unusual to see a single square of glass broken or a brick out of place." Leiden was the cleanest city she had ever seen in her life. And if Braintree in Essex had failed to evoke feelings of ancestral ties, the Church of the Pilgrims at Leiden more than made up for it. In its stillness, she felt the same wave of emotion that had moved Adams to tears on his first visit. At the Amsterdam Stock Exchange, by contrast, the buzz of business being transacted reminded her of nothing so much as the swarming of bees. The reception they were given by the Dutch was warm and heartening. "Striking proof not only of their personal esteem," Abigail wrote, "but of the ideas they entertain with respect to the revolution which gave birth to their connection with us. The spirit of liberty appears to be all alive with them." At Utrecht they witnessed the swearing-in of new magistrates of the city, as a result of major constitutional reforms enacted by the Patriot Party. It was a ceremony conducted, as Adams wrote, "in the presence of the whole city," and it moved him profoundly. To John Jay, he would claim it to be the first bearing of fruit of the American Revolution in Europe. The autumn of 1786 produced no improvement in relations with the British, whose icy civility Adams found all the more galling after the respect and affection he had been shown in Holland. Yet his spirits were high, his health excellent. Besides, he and Abigail knew by then that they were to become grandparents. Nabby was pregnant, her baby expected in April. Not even the news from home of an uprising of aggrieved farmers in western Massachusetts seemed to distress Adams. Shays's Rebellion, as it would come to be known after one of its leaders, Daniel Shays, a former captain in the Continental Army, was in protest of rising taxes and court action against indebted farmers who in many cases were losing their land in the midst of hard times. The insurgents had prevented the sitting of the state Supreme Court at Springfield, but thus far there had been no violence. "Don't be alarmed at the late turbulence in New England," Adams counseled Jefferson. "The Massachusetts Assembly had, in its zeal to get the better of their debt, laid on a tax rather heavier than the people could bear." He was confident all would be well, and concluded prophetically, "This commotion will terminate in additional strength to the government." Inexplicably, correspondence from Jefferson had dwindled to a standstill. On returning from Holland, Abigail had found but one letter waiting, this only to say he did not understand her proposed trade of her son for his daughter, and to relate again his delight in the French. "They have as much happiness in 1 year as an Englishman in 10." After that, there had been no further word. A letter to Adams concerning whale oil sent in late September was written and signed for Jefferson by his aide, William Short. Then, at the end of October, came a brief note to Adams awkwardly written by Jefferson with his left hand. "An unfortunate dislocation of my right wrist has for 3 months deprived me of the honor of writing to you," he at last explained to Abigail before Christmas. But his reason for writing was to tell her that his 8-year-old daughter Polly was on her way to London by ship from Virginia in the care of a nurse, and that he had taken the liberty to tell those who arranged the voyage that you will be so good as to take her under your wing till I can have notice to send for her. What Jefferson said nothing of was that he had been spending as much time as possible through August and September with a beautiful young woman named Maria Cosway. Born of English parents but raised in Italy, she was the wife of a wealthy, dandified English artist, Richard Cosway, and was herself an artist. She was fluent in several languages, musical, slim and delicate, with sparkling blue eyes and a mountain of fashionably dressed blonde hair that made her several inches taller than her tiny, almost dwarf-like husband. The Cosways were a bright fixture in London society, and Abigail and Nabby are known to have met her on at least one social occasion. Maria was 26 years old, Jefferson 43, and the attraction of each to the other was instantaneous. If not in love, Jefferson was wholly infatuated. Wishing only to be with her, he canceled every social engagement he could. As he would tell her, lying messengers were dispatched into every corner of the city with apologies. He bought tickets to the theater, the opera. They rode through Paris in Jefferson's carriage behind a pair of fine new horses, and strolled the gardens at Marly, near Versailles. Sometimes Richard Cosway was with them. More often, they were alone. Whether it was on a walk in the Cours la Reine, as commonly said later, that Jefferson dislocated his wrist, attempting to impress her by vaulting a fence, is not certain. But the accident put an end to their outings, and the pain of the injury was excruciating. For a month, Jefferson was virtually confined to his house, and by early October the Cosways had returned to London. Struggling to write with his left hand, he labored over a carefully composed letter to her in which he described a debate between head and heart, a conventional literary device of the day, and by the end of 12 pages it appeared head was the winner. In any case, when Maria Cosway returned to Paris the next summer, Jefferson showed noticeably less interest in her. To his friends the Adamses, he said nothing of any of this, and possibly they never knew. But then, as the news of Chase's rebellion grew more alarming, an exchange of views on the subject set Abigail and Jefferson sharply in opposition for the first time. To many, on both sides of the Atlantic, it seemed from reports of the tumults in Massachusetts that the new nation was already breaking apart. To the British, accounts in the newspapers only confirmed what they had been predicting all along, while to many Americans, who little understood the suffering of the Massachusetts farmers, and this included Abigail, the situation was an outrage, intolerable. "For what have we been contending against the tyranny of Britain," she asked, writing to Mary Cranch, "to become the sacrifice of a lawless banditti? Will my countrymen justify the maxim of tyrants, that mankind is not made for freedom?" With the arrival of the new year, and still more sensational reports of mob violence in Massachusetts, she let Jefferson know her opinion in no uncertain terms. "Ignorant, restless desperadoes, without conscience or principles, have led a deluded multitude to follow their standard under pretense of grievances which have no existence but in their imaginations." She had no patience with mobs crying out for paper money or the equal distribution of wealth. She saw only the need for the wisest and most vigorous measures to quell and suppress the revolt. It was almost as an afterthought that she told him she would be pleased to look after his daughter as requested. When Jefferson wrote to say he hoped the captured rebels would be pardoned, Abigail was appalled. "The spirit of resistance to government is so valuable on certain occasions that I wish it to be always kept alive," he lectured. "I like a little rebellion now and then. It is like a storm in the atmosphere." How sincerely Jefferson meant what he had written, how much was hyperbole among friends, is difficult to gauge. He had a fondness for the imagery of storms. To Maria Cosway, he had described how sublime it was high on his mountaintop at Monticello, to look down into the workhouse of nature, to see her clouds, hail, snow, rain, thunder, all fabricated at our feet. Moreover, in the same letter to Abigail, he offered the thought that the only hope for change among the ever light-hearted French was not rebellion, but to pray for good kings. Abigail took his wish for a little rebellion now and then quite to heart, and was not pleased. When Jefferson left Paris at the end of February for a long leisurely tour of southern France and Italy, ostensibly to see if the mineral springs at Aix-en-Provence might help his still painful wrist, John Adams kept on writing to him. But Abigail did not. It was the end of June before she could bring herself to write again, and then only to tell Jefferson his daughter had safely arrived. Interestingly, only months afterward, Jefferson would write a letter to her new son-in-law, Colonel Smith, to say he hated the thought of America not having a rebellion such as had occurred in Massachusetts every 20 years or so. What were a few lives lost, Jefferson asked. The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is a natural manure. But of this letter, Abigail apparently knew nothing. On April 2, 1787, Nabby gave birth to a fine boy, William Steuben Smith, who was declared to have the brow of his grandpapa. "I feel already as fond of him as if he was my own son. Nay, I can hardly persuade myself that he is not," Abigail wrote to Lucy Cranch. On June 26th, life picked up still more with the arrival of little Polly Jefferson. She was escorted by the captain of the ship she had sailed on, Andrew Ramsey, to whom she had become so attached that his parting was extremely upsetting for her. "I show her your picture," the Mather Brown portrait, Abigail wrote to Jefferson. "She says she cannot know it. How should she, when she should not know you?" The one surprise, she informed Jefferson, was the nurse who had accompanied the child. The old nurse who you expected to have attended her was sick and unable to come. Instead, she has a girl about 15 or 16 with her, the sister of the servant you have with you, she said, tactfully avoiding the word slave. For Abigail and John Adams, it was their one encounter with Sally Hemings, who was actually 14, younger even than Abigail supposed, and who was to figure years afterward in a sensational scandal surrounding Jefferson's private life. She was also the only slave known ever to have lived under the Adams's roof. To Abigail, Sally seemed nearly as much a child as Polly. In the opinion of Captain Ramsey, as Abigail also related, she would be of so little service that he recommended taking her back to Virginia. Abigail told Jefferson he would have to be the judge. "She seems fond of the child and appears good-natured." On further acquaintance, however, Abigail concluded that the nurse might need more care than the child, and that without supervision would be incapable of her responsibilities. At first, Polly seemed a handful for anyone. Her weeks on board ship had made her as rough as a little sailor. Abigail warmed to her at once. She took her shopping for new clothes and books, kept her at her side as if she were her own. She was a lovely child, the favorite of everyone in the household, Abigail wrote. Adams, as he himself said, was entirely won over. From Polly, they learned her pitiful story. Having no memory of her mother, she had been living with an aunt, Jefferson's sister Elizabeth Epps, whom she adored and had refused to leave when Jefferson sent for her. Deceived into believing that a visit with her cousins on board Captain Ramsey's ship in a Virginia harbor was only for a day or two, she had awakened to find her cousins gone, the ship underway. The deception had made her angry and suspicious, as was still readily evident. Jefferson was at last heard from. Rather than come himself to fetch the child, he was sending his valet, Petit. Having only just returned to Paris from his travels in the South, Jefferson explained, he had the arrearages of 3 or 4 months all crowded on me at once. To the Adamses, it must have seemed a lame excuse, knowing as they did how little there could be of a truly pressing nature to keep Jefferson in Paris, and how competent William Short was to handle what business there was for a week or so, just as he had been doing for months. Abigail was crestfallen. She and the child had both been expecting Jefferson to appear any day. She was distraught, too, at the prospect of sending Polly off with someone who spoke no English. "I am really loath to part with her," she wrote to Jefferson on July 6th, and she, last evening upon Petit's arrival, was thrown into all her former distresses, and bursting into tears, told me it would be as hard to leave me as it was her Aunt Epps. The day of her departure, Polly clung to Abigail's neck weeping, almost in a frenzy. Abigail, too, was crying. To no one, she said, had she ever become so attached in so few days as this little girl. And as time would show, the love she felt for the child was to be her one enduring tie to Jefferson. Section 4. Popularity was never my mistress, nor was I ever, or shall I ever be, a popular man, Adams had written to James Warren at the start of the year, 1787. To say he had just completed a book that was almost certain to make him unpopular. But one thing I know, a man must be sensible of the errors of the people, and upon his guard against them, and must run the risk of their displeasure sometimes, or he will never do them any good in the long run. It was, as Warren doubtless appreciated, about as concise a synopsis of Adams's course through public life as could be found. Once in 1776, writing to Abigail about Thomas Paine's Common Sense, Adams had said of Paine that he was a better hand at pulling down than building. Now, again, he observed to Warren, it is much easier to pull down a government in such a conjuncture of affairs as we have seen than to build up at such season as present. It was Adams's intention to turn to building again. For months after the journey to Holland, he had remained in a state of philosophic solitude, at work in his library, on a consideration of comparative government based on reading and reason. When, the week of Christmas, Abigail went off with the Smiths for a sojourn at Bath, Adams kept steadily at his labors. "Don't be solicitous of me, I shall do very well," he wrote to her Christmas Day. If cold in the night, he would take a virgin to bed. That, he explained, being the English term for a hot water bottle. He felt an urgency like that of 1776. Great events were taking place at home. Support for a stronger central government was gaining ground, and largely in reaction to Shays's rebellion, as Adams had foreseen. A constitutional convention was in the offing. And as he had been impelled in 1776 to write his Thoughts on Government, so Adams plunged ahead now, books piled about him, his pen scratching away until all hours. He is so much swallowed up in the pursuit of his subject that you must not wonder if you do not receive a line from him, Abigail explained to John Quincy. But having read what he was writing, she worried. I tell him they will think in America that he is setting up a king. By early January 1787, Adams had rushed the first installment of his effort to a London printer. Titled A Defense of the Constitutions of Government of the United States of America, it was, in finished production, more a pamphlet than a book, in octavo form, and included on the title page a line from Pope: All nature's difference keeps all nature's peace. Copies were sent off at once to the United States and to Jefferson in Paris. Adams conceded that the writing suffered from too great haste. He called it a strange book, which in many ways it was, much of it a hodgepodge overloaded with historical references and extended borrowings from other writers, and usually without benefit of quotation marks. Yet, in all, he had achieved something quite out of the ordinary, thoughtful, high-minded, and timely. To a considerable extent, the book was an expanded, more erudite rendition of the case for checks and balances in government that he had championed in his Thoughts on Government, and later put into operation in his draft of the Massachusetts Constitution. The people of America now had the best opportunity and the greatest trust in their hands that Providence ever ordained to so small a number since Adam and Eve. There must be three parts to government: executive, legislative, and judicial. And to achieve balance, it was essential that it be a strong executive, a bicameral legislature, and an independent judiciary. On the role of the executive, Adams was emphatic. If there is one central truth to be collected from the history of all ages, it is this: that the people's rights and liberties, and the democratical mixture in a constitution, can never be preserved without a strong executive, or, in other words, without separating the executive from the legislative power. If the executive power, or any considerable part of it, is left in the hands of an aristocratical or democratical assembly, it will corrupt the legislature as necessarily as rust corrupts iron, or as arsenic poisons the human body. And when the legislature is corrupted, the people are undone. Nonetheless, the legislative power was naturally and necessarily sovereign and supreme over the executive. In all history, he declared, there was no greater statesman and philosopher than Cicero, whose authority should ever carry great weight, and Cicero's decided opinion in favor of the three branches of government was founded on a reason that was timeless, unchangeable. Were Cicero to return to earth, he would see that the English nation had brought the great idea nearly to perfection. The English Constitution, Adams declared, and knowing he would be taken to task for it, was the ideal. Indeed, both for the adjustment of the balance and the prevention of its vibrations, it was the most stupendous fabric of human invention in all history. Americans should be applauded for imitating it as far as had been done, but also, he stressed, for making certain improvements in the original, especially in rejecting all hereditary positions. A hereditary monarchy could be a republic, Adams held, as England demonstrated, and hereditary aristocracies could be usefully employed in balanced governments, as in the House of Lords. But Adams adamantly opposed hereditary monarchy and hereditary aristocracy in America, as well as all hereditary titles, honors, or distinctions of any kind. It was why he, like Jefferson and Franklin, strongly opposed the Society of the Cincinnati, the association restricted to Continental Army officers, which had a hereditary clause in its rules whereby membership was passed on to eldest sons. As he explained to Jefferson, much of what he wrote was in response to the dangers of radical French thought. Specifically, he had written in defense, hence the title, against the theories of the philosophe Turgot, who espoused perfect democracy and a single legislature, or, as he wrote, collecting all authority into one center, that of the nation. To Adams, this was patent nonsense. A simple, perfect democracy had never yet existed. The whole people were incapable of deciding much of anything, even on the small scale of a village. He had had enough experience with town meetings at home to know that in order for anything to be done, certain powers and responsibilities had to be delegated to a moderator, a town clerk, a constable, and at times to special committees. Reliance on a single legislature was a certain road to disaster. For the same reason reliance on a single executive, king, potentate, president, was bound to bring ruin and despotism. As the planets were held in their orbits by centripetal and centrifugal forces, instead of rushing to the sun or flying off in tangents among the stars, there must, in a just and enduring government, be a balance of forces. Balance, counterpoise, and equilibrium were ideals that he turned to repeatedly. If all power were to be vested in a single legislature, what was there to restrain it from making tyrannical laws in order to execute them in a tyrannical manner? At home, every state but Pennsylvania and Georgia had a bicameral legislature. And because of the obvious shortcomings of the one-house Congress under the Articles of Confederation, agreement on the need for a bicameral Congress was widespread. So, to a considerable degree, Adams was preaching what had become accepted doctrine at home. Drawing on history and literature, some 50 books altogether, he examined what he called the modern democratic republics, the little Italian Commonwealth of San Marino, Biscay in the Basque region of Spain, the Swiss cantons, modern aristocratic republics, Venice, the Netherlands, and the modern monarchical and regal republics, England, Poland, as well as the ancient democratic, aristocratic, and monarchical republics, including Carthage, Athens, Sparta, and Rome. There were frequent citations in Latin, Greek, and French, extended use of Swift, Franklin, Dr. Price, Machiavelli, Guicciardini's Historia d'Italia, Montesquieu, Plato, Milton, and Hume, in addition to scattered mentions of Aristotle, Thucydides, Hobbes, La Rochefoucauld, and Rousseau, as well as Joseph Priestley, whom Adams had lately come to know in London. But for all this, it remained at heart a lawyer's brief for what he had said in his Thoughts on Government, and what he had helped establish in practice in the Massachusetts Constitution. Where it departed most notably from what he had written before was in its pronouncements on human nature. To Adams, nothing had changed about human nature since the time of the ancients. Inequities within society were inevitable, no matter the political order. Human beings were capable of great good, but also great evil. Thus it had always been, and thus it would ever be. He quoted Rousseau's description of that hideous sight, the human heart, and recounted that even Dr. Priestley had said that such were the weaknesses and folly of men, their love of domination, selfishness, and depravity, that none could be elevated above others without risk of danger. How he wished it were not so, Adams wrote. Thucydides had said the source of all evils was a thirst of power from rapacious and ambitious passions, and Adams agreed. Religion, superstition, oaths, education, laws, all give way before passions, interest, and power. As to the ideal of a nation of equals, such was impossible. Was there, or will there ever be, a nation whose individuals were all equal in natural and acquired qualities, in virtues, talents, and riches? The answer in all mankind must be in the negative. Even in America, where there was a moral and political equality of rights and duties, there were nonetheless inequalities of wealth, education, family position. And such differences were true of all people in all times. There was inevitably a natural aristocracy among mankind, those people of virtue and ability who were the brightest ornaments and the glory of a nation, and may always be made the greatest blessing of society if it be judiciously managed in the Constitution. These were the people who had the capacity to acquire great wealth and make use of political power. And for all they contributed to society, they could thus become the most dangerous element in society unless they and their interests were consigned to one branch of the legislature, the Senate, and given no executive power. Above all, the executive magistrate must have sufficient power to defend himself, and thus the people, from all the enterprises of the natural aristocracy. Adams believed in a government of laws, not of men, as he had written in his Thoughts on Government and in the Massachusetts Constitution. But, as he stressed now in conclusion, the executive power is properly the government. The laws are a dead letter until an administration begins to carry them into execution. Through the months of work on the defense, Adams knew it was time to wind things up in London. He had achieved nothing in his diplomatic role and could expect no improvement in his prospects. Within weeks after the first copies of his defense were ready at the printer, he had written to John Jay to ask that he be recalled. So, while noble in intent, the defense may also have been partly intended as a way of reintroducing himself to his countrymen and influencing the debate on the Constitution. And however apprehensive he may have been over what the reaction might be, he moved ahead without pause, working on two more installments. In February came warm praise from Paris. "I have read your book with infinite satisfaction and improvement," wrote Jefferson. "It would do great good," he predicted. "Its learning and its good sense will, I hope, make it an institute for our politicians, old as well as young." Such approbation was vast consolation, Adams responded, conceding that it had been a hazardous and hasty enterprise, and that he was pursuing it further. There were just two aspects of life in Europe that he regretted leaving. One was access to books, the other was intimate correspondence with you, which is one of the most agreeable events in my life. In time came more praise and approval. From Philadelphia, where the Constitutional Convention had assembled, Benjamin Rush, a member of the convention, wrote that the defense had diffused such excellent principles among us that there was little doubt of our adopting a vigorous and compound federal legislature. James Madison, who had taken the lead in drafting the so-called Virginia Plan, providing for three equal branches in the new government, and who had seldom ever had anything complimentary to say about Adams, declared in a letter to Jefferson that while men of learning would find nothing new in the book, it was certain to be a powerful engine in forming public opinion, and in fact had merit. But as both John and Abigail had anticipated, there were others who perceived dark intent in what he had written. Cotton Tufts warned that there were people sowing discord, claiming Adams was all for monarchy, and planned to put an English prince on a throne in America. In Virginia, the president of the College of William and Mary, a cousin of Madison's, the Reverend James Madison, saw a secret design in the book, that Adams, under the influence of a foreign court, was plotting to overturn the American government. Late that summer of 1787, in Philadelphia, the Constitutional Convention was nearing the completion of its efforts. In Paris, parading mobs and incidents of public disrespect for the royal family had caught many by surprise, including the American ambassador. Suddenly, all tongues had been let loose in Paris, Jefferson reported excitedly to Adams. There were placards all over the city, and though the mobs had ceased, the Queen had received a general hiss while attending the theater. The King, long in the habit of drowning his cares in wine, plunges deeper and deeper. The Queen cries out, but sins on. When copies of the new Constitution of the United States, signed at Philadelphia on September 17th, reached London that autumn, Adams read it with great satisfaction. He would have preferred more power in the presidency than provided, particularly the authority to make presidential appointments without Senate approval. But of greater concern was the absence of a Bill of Rights, in the spirit of what he had written for the Constitution of Massachusetts. What think you of a Declaration of Rights? Should not such a thing have preceded the model? Adams wrote straight off to Jefferson. Writing from Paris a few days later, before receiving Adams's letter, Jefferson said nothing about a Bill of Rights, only that there were things in the Constitution that stagger all my dispositions to subscribe to it. His great concern was the office of the president, which, as conceived, struck him as a bad edition of a Polish king. He may be re-elected from 4 years to 4 years for life, once in office and possessing the military force of the Union, without either the aid or check of a council, he would not be easily dethroned even if the people could be induced to withdraw their votes from him. I wish that at the end of the 4 years, they made him ever ineligible a second time. Here was the difference between them, Adams replied prophetically. You are afraid of the one, I the few. We agree perfectly that the many should have full, fair, and perfect representation in the House. You are apprehensive of monarchy, I of aristocracy. I would therefore have given more power to the President and less to the Senate. He was not so concerned about a president staying long in office, Adams said, as he was about too frequent elections, which often brought out the worst in people and increased the chances of foreign influence. While Jefferson would have much to say about the Constitution and the need for a Bill of Rights in subsequent private correspondence with Madison, he made no public statement for the time being, whereas Adams sent off a strong endorsement to John Jay that was to be widely quoted at home. As once he had seen the Declaration of Independence uniting the different and often disputatious states in common cause, Adams now saw the Constitution as the best means possible to cement all America in affection and interest as one great nation. Indeed, if there was a constant theme in all that Adams wrote and strived for, it was the need for a binding American Union. The public mind cannot be occupied about a nobler object than the proposed plan of government. It appears to be admirably calculated to cement all America in affection and interest as one great nation. A result of accommodation and compromise cannot be supposed perfectly to coincide with anyone's ideas of perfection. But as all the great principles necessary to order, liberty, and safety are respected in it, and provision is made for corrections and amendments as they may be found necessary, I confess I hope to hear of its adoption by all the states. On December 6th, writing to Jefferson, Adams reported that at last his recall had been approved by Congress. And how we say at sea, huzzah for the new world, and farewell to the old one. For the second, and she hoped the last time in her life, Abigail was making arrangements to cross the North Atlantic, and with hardly less apprehension than the time before. There was a great accumulation of clothes, books, china, and furniture to pack, a York rosebush she was determined to take. The furniture included pieces purchased originally for the houses at Amsterdam and The Hague. There was a four-post Dutch bed, a great Dutch chest with heavy brass pulls and claw feet, tables of different sizes, a set of six cushioned Louis XV chairs, and a settee, these with delicate floral carvings. Adams's desk, a beautiful French escritoire of veneered satinwood and ebony, which he had bought in Paris after the war, was his particular pride and joy. All were considerably finer, more elegant pieces than the Adamses had ever owned in years past, and would have looked quite out of place in the farmhouse at Braintree. But, as they now knew, they were not to reside in the old homestead. Through Cotton Tufts, Adams had arranged the purchase of what was known as the Vassal Borland Place, which Adams had had his eye on for years, and which in memory seemed quite grand. Built more than 50 years before, about 1731, as the summer villa of a wealthy sugar planter from the West Indies, Leonard Vassal, the house had stood empty through much of the war, after Vassal's daughter, the widow Borland, a loyalist, fled to England. When Adams heard the place was available, he made his decision. Located on the coast road on the north side of town, the property included house, farm buildings, and some 80 acres at a purchase price of £600. Adams envisioned it as the ideal setting for his retirement. There were friends in London for Abigail to say goodbye to, last letters to get off to her sisters, and to John Quincy, who, having finished Harvard, was now studying law and not very pleased about it. When Mary Cranch wrote to report that their brother William had died, Abigail was devastated. Reflection on such bad news was too painful for her, she wrote in reply. Nor was there time for reflection. Her maid, Esther Field, had discovered with an astonishment equal nearly to Abigail's own that she was pregnant, with the child of the ever-faithful footman John Breesler, and both wished to be married before sailing for home. The first week in February, Adams paid a final call at Whitehall. On February 20th, he had his audience of leave with George III, who in parting said, "Mr. Adams, you may with great truth assure the United States that whenever they shall fulfill the treaty on their part, I, on my part, will fulfill it in all its particulars." More than this, however, Adams was to remember the king's graciousness toward him. Then, out of the blue, and to his utter dismay, Adams was called on to make one last emergency trip to Holland, and in the worst possible season to cross the North Sea. It was essential that he take formal leave of his ambassadorial post there, he was informed, and to secure yet another loan, this to enable the United States to make its payments on earlier loans from the Dutch. To Adams, the journey was punishment for sins unknown. The single consolation was that Jefferson was to meet him at Amsterdam. Together they succeeded with the Dutch bankers and in high spirits agreed that when the time came that Adams was at last on his way to heaven, he would surely have first to negotiate another Dutch loan. It was the last time they ever collaborated in a public matter. To Abigail, Jefferson had written, "I have considered you while in London as my neighbor, and look forward to the moment of your departure from thence as to an epoch of much regret and concern to me. My daughters join me in affectionate adieu. Polly does not cease to speak of you with warmth and gratitude. Heaven send you, madam, a pleasant and safe passage." It was a charming letter of the kind at which Jefferson excelled, and that by now he was writing to a number of women within his Paris circle, who, in addition to Maria Cosway, included Anne Bingham and another equally striking American, Angelica Church, as well as several French women of note, all of whom, interestingly, were married. Writing to Jefferson, in the midst of the bustle and fatigue of packing, Abigail said simply and sincerely that she could not leave without sending a few lines to my much-esteemed friend, to thank him for all his kindness and friendship towards myself and family. The American minister, his wife, and two American servants departed London for the last time on Sunday, March 30, 1788, by coach for Portsmouth, where they were to sail on the American ship Lucretia, bound for Boston. The Smiths, with their infant son, were to sail on another ship for New York, the temporary federal capital, where Colonel Smith planned to pursue his career. Mr. Adams, the late envoy from the American States, set off for Portsmouth on Sunday last to embark for his return, read a small item in the Whitehall Evening Post. That gentleman settled all his concerns with great honor, and whatever his political tenets may have been, he was much respected and esteemed in this country. Because of bad weather, it was another 3 weeks before the Adamses were truly under way. As Abigail fervently wished, she and John were never to see England or Europe again. Henceforth, she wrote on board in her diary, she would be quite content to learn what more there was to know of the world from the pages of books. Adams is not known to have recorded any of his thoughts during the voyage home, but earlier he had said his great desire was to lay fast of the town of Braintree and embrace it with both arms and all my might. There live, there to die, there to lay my bones, and there to plant one of my sons in the profession of law and the practices of agriculture like his father. Only Nabby, it seems, strongly objected. Their father had still more to do for his country, she had written to John Quincy. By his opinions, advice, and recommendations, he has, I believe, in his power to do as much, perhaps the most, towards establishing her character as a respectable nation of any man in America. And shall he retire from the world and bury himself amongst his books and live only for himself? No, I wish it not. The Americans in Europe say he will be elected vice president. Besides, my brother, independent of other considerations, he would not, I am well convinced, be happy in private life. John Adams was 52. Except for the few months he had spent in Massachusetts in 1778, he had been away for 10 years. In that time he had traveled thousands of miles in France, Spain, the Netherlands, and England. He had repeatedly crossed the English Channel and the North Sea, and his voyage home now marked his fourth crossing of the Atlantic. Altogether, by land and sea, he journeyed more than 29,000 miles, farther than any leading American of his time in the service of his country, never once refusing to go because of difficulties or unseasonable conditions, or something else that he would have preferred to do. He had first sailed for Europe in the midst of war. He was returning now after more than 5 years of peace. For him, personally, the homeward passage marked as clear an end to one chapter of his life and the beginning of another as had his initial voyage out. The intervening years in Europe had been as memorable and important, he felt, as any in his life. Through the first years in France, for all his troubles with Franklin, he had worked steadily with the old patriot, and often with telling effect. That he had pressed doggedly for a greater part in the war by the French Navy would stand as one of his own proudest efforts, and with reason, given what happened at Yorktown. With his success obtaining Dutch loans at the critical hour of the Revolution, he felt, as did others, that he had truly saved his country. That he had embarked on such an unprecedented mission on his own initiative, that he had undertaken his own one-man diplomatic campaign knowing nothing initially of the country, its language, and with no prior contacts or friendships to call upon, and yet carried through to his goal, were simply extraordinary, and a measure of his almost superhuman devotion to the American cause. His part in the Paris Peace Treaty would stand the test of time, Adams believed, as much as anything he had ever done. If the years and effort at London had come to naught, he at least knew he had given devoted service, conducting himself with consistent aplomb and dedication. No one could fault him for a false step, nor could it be imagined that another of his countrymen in the same role could have done better. Of the overwhelming convulsion soon to come in France, of the violent end in the offing for the whole European world Adams had come to know, he appears to have had few, if any, premonitions, no more than anyone else. What changes had taken place at home in his absence, he could only imagine. But clearly, with the advent of the new Constitution, a new epoch had opened in the history of his country. For her part, Abigail speculated privately that any further role in politics might be a little like getting out of the frying pan and into the fire. Part 3. Independence Forever. Our obligations to our country never cease but with our lives. John Adams. Chapter 8. Heir Apparent. Gentlemen, I feel a great difficulty how to act. I am vice president. In this, I am nothing, but I may be everything. John Adams. Section 1. On the crystal clear morning of Tuesday, June 17, 1788, the keeper of the Boston Lighthouse, Thomas Knox, sighted the Lucretia making good speed on the northeast horizon, and by prearranged plan he set in motion a welcome home such as John Adams had never imagined. The landmark lighthouse, the first built in America, stood 10 miles out from Boston on a tiny rock island at the head of the harbor. For more than half a century, since before John Adams was born, it had taken the brunt of the open Atlantic, only to be blown up by the British in 1776. Rebuilt since the war, it stood again as before, and for those on board the inbound ship, after a rough crossing of 58 days, its granite tower gleaming in the sunshine of a perfect morning was a thrilling sight. At the signal from Lightkeeper Knox, cannon boomed at the fort on Castle Island to alert the town. Losing no time, Knox then set sail by pilot boat to meet the Lucretia and deliver an official welcome to Minister Adams and his lady from Governor John Hancock. "My coach will be at the end of Long Wharf," Hancock had written. The Adamses were to proceed to a reception in their honor at his Beacon Hill home, where he hoped they would tarry till you have fixed upon your place of abode. As the ship cleared the lighthouse and swept into the harbor, the green hills of Braintree stood forth on the port side, while ahead rose Boston's multiple church steeples. Again, cannon thundered from Castle Island in official salute, and in little time the ship was tying up at dockside, where a crowd of several thousand was gathered. People were cheering, church bells ringing, as the Adamses came ashore. Along the route to Beacon Hill, more throngs lined the streets. The bells in the several churches rang during the remainder of the day. Every countenance wore the expressions of joy, reported the Massachusetts Sentinel. For John and Abigail, who in their long absence had often felt unappreciated or forgotten, such an outpouring was inexpressibly gratifying, but also difficult to take in. Hancock, who adored ceremony and show, was so delighted by the excitement, he insisted the next day that he escort them to Braintree in his coach, and that they go accompanied by cavalry. But the Adamses had had enough fanfare, and departed Boston on their own. At Braintree they moved in quietly with the Cranches until their furniture could be delivered from the ship. The first days at Braintree were a continuing round of emotional reunions, with the Cranches, sons Charles and Thomas, and John's astonishingly spry mother, now 79. John's brother, Peter, Cotton Tufts, and Parson Wyburd, plus a score of Quincy's, Basses, and other old friends and neighbors. John Quincy arrived by horseback from Newburyport, where he was reading law. Adams rejoiced in the sight of his sons. Charles, 18, and Thomas, 15, both Harvard scholars now and inches taller than their mother, had been small boys when he last saw them. John Quincy, soon to turn 21, was clearly a grown man, and his father's pride and joy were no less than ever. "The oldest has given decided proofs of great talents, and there is not a youth his age whose reputation is higher for abilities or whose character is fairer in point of morals of conduct," he wrote to Nabby. "The youngest is as fine a youth as either of the three, if a spice of fun in his composition should not lead him astray. Charles wins the heart as usual, and is the most a gentleman of them all." "Busy unpacking during the whole day," recorded John Quincy, once the furniture and belongings arrived and the move to the new house began. Another day was devoted to unpacking his father's books. "Yet we did not get half enough." The Shaws arrived from Haverhill. There were teas and dinners at the Cranches. At church on Sunday, the combined family filled several pews. Parson Wyburd preached in his usual dull, unanimated strain, fumed John Quincy, who had never understood his father's admiration for the eccentric preacher. To Abigail's great disappointment, the new house, the old Vassal Borland place, once thought an elegant country seat, was found to be in poor repair, and distressingly small and cramped after what she had known in Europe. Her sense of scale had changed more than she knew. The white clapboard house was handsome enough and stood by itself, uncrowded by the side of a main road with farmland stretching before and behind. But there were just six rooms, and ceilings were low. "In height and breadth, it feels like a wren's house," she wrote. For days, house and grounds were overrun with carpenters, masons, and farmhands. Some of her furniture had been badly damaged at sea. "But you know there is no saying nay," she added gamely. Adams could not have been more pleased with his new estate, as he wrote to an English friend. "It is not large in the first place. It is but the farm of a patriot." Spirits high, he plunged into the farmer's life, tramping his fields and pastures, inspecting walls, appraising livestock, hiring help, discussing weather and crops, and delegating projects. A French writer, J.P. Brissot de Varville, stopping at Braintree on a tour of America to examine the effects of liberty upon men, society, and government, described Farmer Adams as like one of the generals and ambassadors of the golden ages of Rome and Greece, forgetful of his books and royal courts. After a visit to Mount Vernon, Brissot would write much the same of George Washington. But another French traveler would be astonished to find a man of such consequence as Adams living in a house so small that, as he wrote, "no Paris lawyer of the lowest rank would choose it for a country seat." Speculation on Adams's political future was rampant. He was talked of as governor, senator, vice president, everything but president. According to the Sentinel, it was already certain he would become vice president, and if not that, chief justice of the Supreme Court. "And who can object to Mr. Adams?" asked the paper, which, after enumerating his many abilities and attainments, observed that he happened also to be, providentially, unemployed. Henry Knox and Benjamin Lincoln, two stalwarts of 1776, and now of formidable political importance, came to talk. Benjamin Rush wrote from Philadelphia, warmly endorsing the prospect of his old friend as vice president. Ezra Stiles, president of Yale, in a letter informing Adams that he had received an honorary degree from Yale, said he rejoiced at the thought of Adams for vice president. In keeping with the unwritten rule of the time that any display of ambition would be unseemly, Adams kept silent. But, in fact, he had decided from the time he arrived home that he would accept the vice presidency, and that role only, any other being beneath him, as Abigail put it confidentially in a letter to Nabby. The makeup of political leadership in the country had greatly changed in Adams's absence. Many with whom he had served in the Continental Congress had passed from the scene. Some, like Benjamin Rush, were retired from public life, others deceased. 14 of those who had signed the Declaration of Independence were dead, including Stephen Hopkins and Caesar Rodney. And much about politics was now in the hands of new men, smart young men, known to Adams only by reputation. Madison